told you before, I didn't want you to read this crap. I never saw such rotten crap in my life. Want to know where this is going, Billy? In the garbage, right into the freaking garbage.
Daddy, please don't throw it away. I'm sorry.
The next time, young man, I find you with a worthless piece of shit like this again, you won't sit down for a week, buddy boy.
I hope you rot in hell.
Creepshow is George Romero and Stephen King's homage to EC Comics and the things that influenced them as far as growing up as deranged horror-loving kids. It's a Valentine to horror movies. It covers, all the stories cover, you know, a different type of horror. It's this beautiful combination of scares and humor, and its style of filmmaking is so exaggerated and really captures, probably more so than even say something like Sin City, the comic book style. And when I saw it, it was not like anything I'd seen before. It scared me to death when I was a kid. It thrilled me, and it was absolutely my gateway into the horror genre proper, and it got me interested in all facets of filmmaking, from directing to writing to the scoring, and especially the special effects. At the time, it introduced me to Fangoria magazine. It just opened up a whole world to me that I didn't know before, and the whole world of filmmaking. And that was really the first time that I started to really know that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
You're listening to the Scream Addicts Podcast. I'm Jinx, your host, and that was Dave Parker talking about George A. Romero's 1982 horror anthology, Creepshow. Mr. Parker is a filmmaker known for such films as The Dead Hate the Living, The Hills Run Red, It Watches, and Sweet Tooth, that awesome segment in the recent horror anthology, Tales of Halloween. Mr. Parker, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm so excited to be on and to be able to talk about this movie that I so dearly love.
Okay, so you chatted about it a bit already, but can I ask, of any horror movie you might have chosen, any at all, why go with specifically Creepshow?
Well, it was a very daunting choice when you really think about it, even with the many films that have already been covered here. But it really came down to what was the film that made me want to do what I do. And the one that I just dearly love and I can throw on at any time. I mean, to the point of I can almost recite the movie back to myself as it plays. I just know it so well. And you never forget your first love. And Creepshow honestly was my first love. And I'm so glad it was this and not some movie that now I would look at and go, oh boy, that's terrible. This is just a wonderful, it's just a wonderful film. And to me, it's timeless. It doesn't feel, you know, the only thing that might feel dated is maybe some hairstyles and a little of the incidental music. But I just think it's got a little bit of scares. It's got some very dark humor. It's got some blood in it. It's just sort of got a little bit of everything. And the fact that it's an anthology and you go, well, that kind of horror isn't my thing. You have something else coming up shortly after. And it deals with a lot of fears. And it's also made by two of the greatest in the horror genre. I mean, George Romero and Stephen King, certainly at their prime, you know, when they were probably both at their most popular.
Yeah, absolutely. And doing amazing work, too. And thank God that, you know, I think you're right. The movie has aged really well. There's so many horror movies that I caught when I was a kid that, you know, a few decades later, they don't really hold up. And the two that really, really scared me. you know, I was sort of terrified to revisit them were, you know, Creepshow and The Monster Squad. And thank goodness, you know, when I checked them out again, you know, on DVD when eventually they hit, you know, they still hold up. You know, the one thing that I do really love about the film is that, you know, in addition to being a horror anthology, it does really embrace its roots, you know, being a throwback to those EC comics. And around the time that Tales from the Crypt was playing on HBO, all of those comics were getting reprinted. You know, you had Tales from the Crypt and Shock Suspense Stories and Vault of Horror and The Haunt of Fear, all of those. And I was actually collecting those because I really wanted to watch the HBO show, but that was a little too adult for me at the time. So I had to make do with the more, you know, tame comics, as it were, even though they weren't all that tame. But, you know, by the time I eventually got around to watching Creepshow as a kid, I sort of immediately recognized that the movie was paying homage to those types of comics, right down to replicating those sort of shock panels with somebody, you know, dead center of the frame, you know, saying something like, "Good Lord, choke," you know, and there being like a brightly designed background that really makes no sense whatsoever. But it's purely a stylistic thing to show the horror of the situation. And the fact that Romero was so bold to shoot the movie with those types of images and to hit the frame with those sort of garish colors, you know, the massive like sort of blue gels and red gels, you know, making it like a living comic. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Sin City. I think Sin City was the first movie since Creepshow to to take such effort in really reproducing what it feels like to watch a comic book or to read a comic book anyway, but to, you know, to actually see it in live action. I think arguably Ang Lee's Hulk movie, you know, tried to do the same thing to, you know, kind of a lesser degree. But I love it so much for that. And I wish that more people attempted that. But outside of the Creepshow series, I can't really think of many other movies that tried to do that so far as trying to bring a horror comic to life in such a way.
No, and I don't think that, I mean, I don't think there's been that much, maybe there's not been that much opportunity because, you know, horror comics now and everything take a very different approach, you know, to the material. It's not, you know, even, you know, in the same vein as what Creepshow did. What I liked is you could feel the love of making this movie pour off of it. And I definitely know, like, for me, watching it the first time, it was the first time that I really noticed filmmaking because it was so exaggerated. I was a young kid, and funny enough that at the time, horror films, at least modern horror films, really disturbed me and scared me. And I saw the commercial play on television before it opened, and I just remember telling my dad, "We're going to see this." I don't even know why, but it looked so fun, and I was very much into Stephen King. I can't even say that I really knew who George Romero was that moment before I went and saw the movie. I think I was too young to have seen Night of the Living Dead and his other films before Creepshow. So, I think I was aware of Dawn of the Dead, but I certainly hadn't seen it. And then when I saw it and seeing this, the exaggerated angles and the exaggerated lighting and the comic book framing and, you know, everything he did aesthetically for it, it just really made me aware of filmmaking because it was so in your face and obvious, and it was so meant not to be subtle in any way. But it all worked. It all came together, at least in my opinion. And then I was like, this is what I want to do. And I think even subliminally, I think a lot of that stuff has influenced the films that I've done because for the most part, I think that I'm not a big fan of the horror movie that's incredibly desaturated of color and everything. And I like my horror to be fun. It doesn't have to be comedic. But I like it to be a ride, and I like, you know, I appreciate all kinds, and I appreciate movies that just bring me dread and just really get under my skin. But I would say that the movies that feel like a roller coaster to me, that are a ride, are the things that I gravitate towards the most because of seeing Creepshow and having that experience and the feelings that I had. I mean, I laughed. It's funny now when I tell people, it's like, oh yeah, at the time Creepshow scared me to death. My imagination was just running so wild with it, and every jump scare worked for me. Everything just worked on me in a way, and all the monsters and the creatures and everything else. It was just something that I really hadn't experienced to that level before. And wow, I love thinking back on that, because for me there was this innocence, or being naive about how things are made, and I like that, because I think so much is so calculated now, and I think they approached it with a almost childlike glee and innocence of when they were reading the EC comics, and it seemed like everyone making that movie was in on it. They knew what they were making. No one acting in that movie or working on it we're above this, we don't get the joke, oh, we want to be serious. None of that was there. It just, everyone got it. And I think that affection for what they were doing just really shines through, and just make, now it's, one of your other guests compared another movie as comfort food. This is definitely comfort food for me.
Yeah. And I miss that kind of approach to storytelling, and not that we don't get it these days, but it doesn't seem to be so often that we do, there, that sort of glee, at dealing with macabre material, and for that matter, we don't really get anthologies that much anymore, at least not so far as on a wide scale. I mean, you think back to the days of, I don't know, like Amicus, where multiple stars could be contracted for a couple of days' work on any of the, the various stories in a horror anthology. And apparently they did quite well. And then it seems like they kind of died off. And I'm thinking, when was the last time a horror anthology hit the screen in wide release? Was it like Tales from the Dark Side or Tales from the Hood? They seem to be making a resurgence on VOD and the direct-to-video market, what with, Trick or Treat and the ABCs of Death films and the VHS series and Southbound and XX and the Theater Bazaar and, Tales of Halloween, of course. But do you see horror anthologies becoming a mainstream thing again ever, with successful releases on 4,000 screens with some regularity? Or do you think those days are gone?
I think if a big enough name director did one, there would be interest. What's interesting now with the anthology is that they're being done by multiple directors. I mean, Tales, we had 11 directors doing 10 stories. All the VHS and ABCs of Death and XX, they're all multiple directors, each contributing a story. Whereas before, it was one director directing all the stories. It was more of a anchored vision doing them. So I think also the reason that we're getting them is they're a relatively economical investment. They're not spending $2 million per story. The budgets are usually pretty low, but it's a great platform if you get the right sort of hook into the overall aesthetic of the movie to let some new voices shine. And I know what was exciting for us when we did Tales of Halloween was just the chance to do what we wanted and the freedom. And I definitely, with mine, I definitely hearken back to Creepshow with the tone and the flavor and even the style. I wanted mine to be very traditionally shot and have that color and have a very EC Comics Creepshow sort of feel to it. And I've been very, gratified that people really responded to that one in that way. They seem to think that's a good way to start it off. And but it's just my sensibility too of wanting to do that kind of story. And I think there's been some really, really interesting shorts in there if people give them a chance. I think there's some really cool stuff in Southbound. Again, with XX, there's, each one is so different. I think it's a great, that one's a perfect example. There's a great showcase for female directors who don't usually get to do this. Tales, we had one female director. And that really just came down to, we did it as a group of friends who all hung out. It's not that we don't hang out with, but honestly, I don't know, in our closer Los Angeles vicinity, that we had access to and knew a lot of female directors. And I don't mean to disparage the female directors that we do know, but there was a criteria of experience that we had that sort of qualified, and the fact that we all regularly socialize together and hang out. So that's what that one was. But I think that's what's interesting. And maybe if you got, the closest you would get would be Trick or Treat or Sin City, where it was one director doing multiple stories, but it was one vision. And that seems to have changed a lot since, I would say, Tales from the Hood was probably the last real successful theatrical one, which I think is great. I mean, and that goes into a whole different area. And I know they, the two filmmakers, Darren Scott and Rusty Cundiff, have got a new anthology coming where they both directed stories this time. And they're working on, doing more of that stuff because they love it too, but they approach it as a more, in some ways, socially conscious, stories and parables.
Which is great. And Tales from the Hood, that was over 20 years ago. I, given that anthologies, can tell different stories and, you can bring in other directors or have a director do, all of the tales himself, or and you don't have to contract, say, actors to be in them for more than just a small amount of time, a fraction of what the entire shoot would be. I would almost think with that more economical style of storytelling, especially in this day and age, that anthologies would be more popular than ever. But they really seem to have gone away so far as, again, big studios are concerned. And I'm wondering, why? What do you think contributed to their dying off?
I think part of it is that some of these were not making big enough money for the studios. Look at what the studios are making now, and the horror stuff is, for the most part, with the exception of Blumhouse, they're much larger budgets, and there's a bigger risk. And it might be that that the filmmakers haven't really proposed or brought forth an idea of hey, I want to do an anthology. It could be that. I think the fact that television has in some ways done it better and anthologized horror in a way. Now we're getting anthology series in a way where you get a whole season of one particular horror, like American Horror Story does. I think just changing times. And honestly, it's always an interesting thing that unless it's, a $50 million promotional budget or more, is the audience there to go theatrically? Or are they going to go, I'm going to wait and I'll just catch on VOD. There's also that factor that the demand just might not be there. But again, even in the 80s, there weren't too many big theatrical anthologies and, you know, even up through the 90s. There just haven't been. I mean, even when you look at the ratio in the 70s when Amicus was going around and they were making all these were not – there was less to risk because there were more avenues than to have these films be theatrical or in the drive-in. I just think that the nature of filmmaking and distribution and everything else has changed a lot in the way people consume, you know, movies these days, especially horror films. I think the hardcore horror fan is really looking more at VOD and finding those hidden gems than, with exceptions, rushing out to the theater. Because I think it's an expensive cost now to go to the movies. So I think in some ways they want more of a guarantee that they're going to get their, say, $20 to go to a theater and see a movie. They want more of a guarantee that they're going to feel satisfied or something. I mean, to me, it's crazy, but it's just the mentality of companies and studios and their bottom line. And then probably a lot of red tape, you know. I mean, when you're looking at an anthology and making one, you're okay. Well, we got multiple cast and we got multiple locations, and it becomes sort of this production Rubik's cube of like, how do we make all this line up so it can all work in this defined shooting schedule and get this all done when we're, you know, maybe 3 or 5 days later, basically resetting the entire thing. Where it's like, well, we could just do one movie set in one location and do that really well, and we'll save costs. There's always the business side, which is boring to talk about.
Yeah. That does bum me out, though. I that makes total sense, and I guess I can see why anthologies aren't, you know, as popular as they used to be, so far as, you know, them being made. But, God, I love them so much. As a horror fan, I love the sampler platter nature of horror anthologies, even when, you know, they're all tied together by theme or style, or, you know, even when they're not, even when they're kind of a grab bag of tales. I just I adore them, and I blame that in part on Creepshow, which I think is as perfect a horror anthology as there ever was.
Yeah, I do too. I really do think it is absolutely. To me, there are no duds in there. Because they're okay. They're palate cleansers. Oh, you don't like this one, but this one's a little different. But they all, to me, still work, and they all have a really great payoff.
You know, before we dive into each one of them, I've got an idea. Sure. Something a little different for this podcast. Usually we only have one movie to talk about, and so we just start at the beginning and we kind of work our way through. Given that Creepshow is an anthology, how about we break them up into their individual stories, you know, going from one to one? So, you know, if we have, I don't know, it's kind of a self-contained story in its own right, the wraparound with young Billy, you know, reading Creepshow and his father, Stan, Tom Atkins, and, mm-hmm. you know, sort of, it's kind of like peak Tom Atkins at that point. 80s Tom Atkins, you know, that was the era of what? Halloween 3 and Night of the Creeps and, you know, this. And The Fog. The Fog was the 80s too, right? Or is that late 70s? No, that's 80s, right?
That was 80.
I'm a bad fan.
That was 1980. So this was after The Fog. it might have been, I don't know if, I think he had maybe done Halloween 3. He might have shot Halloween 3. It may not have been released until 83, potentially. He might. But yeah, definitely peak Atkins. It's definitely the peak of Atkins, which I think like culminated with, you know, you got Lethal Weapon and Night of the Creeps. It's like prime time Atkins. Absolutely.
That should be the title of his biography, I think. Or a biopic, at least. He's great. And, it, you know, it does start the movie out on that perfect note where it lets you know that this is very much going to be a comic book tale. But it also sort of, you know, who in the audience who isn't a horror fan wouldn't feel some sort of sympathy for young Billy, you know, getting swatted in the face by his father after, you know, been having or after having, you know, that comic book taken away from him, you know,
thrown in the garbage, just the worst. And I certainly, you know, related to him because it's like half the toys they show in his room I had. I'm like, that's me, you know? So yeah. And then just to have a comic book thrown away, which was that was just the worst.
Yeah. And it is strange though. I love that opening, but it is a little bizarre that the father took such exception to the horror comic while standing in a room filled with monster toys and a Dracula poster and a skull, you know, sitting on a shelf. It's like, what? This is a father who does not know his son at all.
Well, but the other thing is what it did, especially to me when I was seeing it for the first time, was like, oh man, this kid's got all this stuff in his room and everything. This comic book's got to be really intense. It just, to me, it built up what was going to come. And I remember when the creep shows up at his window and he's sort of happy. And I kind of got that because he was really cool looking and like, wow, that's awesome. But I was so unprepared for when the lightning struck and it turned into animation. I'm like, whoa, what is this? This is amazing.
Yeah, it's gorgeous too. And the fact that, you know, I love that, you know, in yet another nod to EC Comics, that they do have their own Crypt Keeper style, you know, ghoul to sort of tell each story. Even though if I had one, and I do mean one minor nitpick with the movie, it's that we never really got a chance to see the creep introduce the stories other than those comic book panels where you see him, you know, talking as he would in, you know, the panels of any one of the Creepshow comics. You know, and I will say, I just as a weird aside, like, I do think it's really cool that they got like an EC comic book artist to actually do the comic style artwork for the film. I think his name was Jack Kamen.
Yeah, and he did the one with the creep at the window. Not at the movie theater, but he actually did the one sheet poster that is the creep at the window and everything else. But yeah, no, it was, all that stuff was perfect to me. And I never felt like, oh, I'm gypped out of a Crypt Keeper Tales from the Crypt sort of intro with this ghostly apparition, because it just seems so perfect to go into the comic book panel that he's talking and not hear him, because I could never, I don't know if you could ever have the voice talking to you ever really match up to the image. And I think I would have been like disappointed.
Yeah. They attempted that with Creepshow 2 in it.
but to me, that was a totally different character.
Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. You know, in the sense of the creep, I think they just were like, okay, well, we don't want to do this. We're going to try something else. And, yeah, to me, Creepshow 2 does not work anywhere near as well. And it's odd to me that one has become so beloved, because I remember when I was very excited for Creepshow 2. And then when I went and saw it, I was like, yeah, this to me lost all the charm of the first one.
Which is crazy because, I mean, you know, even with, yeah, I could go on and on about Creepshow 2. I don't understand sort of its weird resurgence recently. I mean, the fact that Arrow released it on Blu-ray is kind of stunning to me. I don't know that this is just one guy's opinion. I'm not certain that the movie deserves that sort of treatment. But, you know, that's just me. But, yeah, the creep as he appears in that second film, it's, you know, it's an impressive makeup effect and the animation's kind of cool, but it doesn't have the same impact as just that creepy puppet figure that's beckoning at Billy's window at the very beginning. Which I should point out one thing too, like, how crazy is it that it is Stephen King's own son playing Billy, who would grow up to be Joe Hill, the great author who gave us like, you know, 20th Century Ghosts and Heart-Shaped Box and Horns and Lock and Key. And he is Billy reading the comic at the very beginning and giving a really, really creepy performance. I mean, when he hisses under his breath about how he hopes his dad burns in hell, I mean, it's it's a little intense.
More than a little. What a better way to sort of start your career. Go, yeah, I was the kid in Creepshow. Now I'm this amazing author. I love that, though. I mean, I think any horror fan kid would be like, I wish that was me. I wish I was the kid in Creepshow. I wish I had been, gotten that part. It was very cool.
I still want to be the kid from Creepshow with like the voodoo doll.
I want his toys now.
Yeah.
I want his toys and I want everything that was ever advertised in that comic book, including the voodoo doll. It's like, I'd love a replica of that comic book. It would be amazing.
Well, there is the Bernie Wrightson illustrated comic, which actually just got reprinted, I think, only a month or two ago. It has all the tales. It has that great Bernie Wrightson artwork. I don't know if they actually reprinted the ads within the comic, but I would like to think that they did. I need to snag a copy of that.
The Wrightson adaptation and the King one, obviously it's truncated, it's shorter and everything else. But I remember getting that before the movie came out. And looking at it, and it still didn't matter. Like looking at the comic book and everything that happens in the comic book and stuff, and then seeing the movie, the movie still worked on me like gangbusters. And I still have that first release of it. But the new release, they didn't like add anything to it. It's an exact reproduction of the original release of it. But that artwork is amazing.
Wrightson was the king. I think they said that Kamen did the cover artwork for it, but all of the interiors, Wrightson stuff. And I'm so bummed that we lost him not that long ago, because I think he was one of the greatest comic book artists ever to work.
He was the greatest horror comic artist of all time. And
hands down, his Swamp Thing stuff, like the first 10 issues, is just incredible.
Yeah, I was lucky enough through my friend David Scow to know Bernie. And I know his son now, John, who's an amazing sculptor and effects artist in his own right. And it was such a loss. And it was so nice to see all the tributes to this man who was such an influential artist and so amazing. And Creepshow, again, was my first introduction to him.
We had the comic, and we had that comic style opening that sort of carries us into the movie after that, the beginning of that book ending sequence. And then from there, we get Father's Day.
Oh, a bunch of dirty fighters just waiting to get your hands on my money.
Father's Day. I got my cake.
Oh my God!
Happy Father's Day.
I think even more so than the wraparound, Father's Day is the perfect beginning to Creepshow. I mean, for the type of story it tells, it's almost, in a way, it's a perfect EC comic story, up to a point. But I don't know, how would you rank it so far as the others go? Is it one of your favorites? Is it one that you merely sort of enjoy? Or what's your overall feeling about Father's Day?
I love Father's Day. It ranks very high, like top three easily, because it's very classic. The performances are really fun and exaggerated. You get Vivica Lindford's as Aunt Bedelia, and all the stuff with the flashbacks. And I mean, it's a great introduction to the style of the movie with the comic framing and panels, and at the time it really scared me. I mean, I still think it has the best jump scare when Nathan's hand shoots out of the grave. and what I loved about it was, and then the lighting right then turns red, you know, on the hand, and it turns, it's the start of this exaggerated style. But I thought Carrie Nye, who played Sylvia, who's chain smoking, and she just had these black eyes and this weird, you know, this opulent mansion that they live in. I just loved it. And then, you know, and now when you look at it, you have Ed Harris playing a small supporting role, and you have, you know, just these spoiled, rotten, rich people who are just getting their due. And it's just so great. And I remember being really disturbed and freaked out by the hitting of the cane on the wheelchair and that sound. And I thought the graveyard was this very creepy, beautiful looking, you know, set piece. And it was, that's the thing. It was, I'm sure to an adult at the time, it was maybe felt kind of cheesy or whatever. But to me as a kid, it was all very creepy. It was all very scary. You know, when Ed Harris falls into the grave and then Aunt Bedelia's body like drapes over him and keeps him trapped there. And then he gets slammed by the gravestone and you're just going, oh my God.
Were you like me in that at some point when you first saw the movie, you screamed, just move, damn it. Just get up. Come on.
Sort of, but I was also just so into it. And the corpse and the Nate corpse really just disturbed me and freaked me out as a kid. There were, you know, the maggots in the eyes and stuff. I hadn't seen that level of makeup effects before that I like clearly remembered. And I was just like, and there was this sense of dread. I remember the most dread that I felt was right at the end where Richard and Cass, the brother and sister, they're going to go look for Richard, and they go through the kitchen and they see the dirt footprint on the floor. And then he looks up and I'm like going, no, 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 don't open the door. Don't open the door. And then they do. And then it's this big, loud music sting. And you see Sylvia's head on a platter and everything. And you're just like, ah, it was to me, it was just like such a great way to start the movie. I was like, I'm in, I'm scared to death, but I'm in.
Yeah. And that moment, that final image is actually captured now in an action figure, a little 3.75 inch figure featuring zombie Nathan and his cake. Well, you know, the severed head, yes, as his cake. But I think it's a Monstars action figure of that story. I saw an ad for it recently and I was like, ah, God, I hope this becomes a line. You know, I want a fluffy action figure, damn it. So
do I. There's another company that's been working on this figure for 5 years, a Nate corpse with Sylvia's head, which is a 12-inch, very detailed figure that is coming out. And I've had it on order for almost 5 years now. It was like, and people on Facebook have been messaging the company and going, you are a ripoff artist and everything else. And it's all finally coming together. And I've just been waiting and waiting because the detail and everything is so dead on. And it comes with the tombstone and all the stuff. It's amazing. So when I saw the smaller action figure, I was like, yeah, that's nice, but I'm waiting for the real deal. This big one here. So I can't wait. But I love that design. They made back in the day, before there were all these mask makers who now do their sort of own private licensed creep show masks and stuff like that. I remember they mass produced a Nate Halloween mask, which I got as a kid.
Really?
Which I'm not sure if it came from Savini's molds, but it was it was really dead on. I mean, obviously you didn't get the moss or the fake maggots and stuff like that with the eyes, but it was really good. They did that, and they did a Fluffy, and they were mass produced at the time. And I remember getting the Nate one and having that for a long time until it finally just sort of dissolved because it was latex and it was, you know, old. But yeah, I really love Father's Day because I love everything about it. It's just, again, and I love because I think I love that one so much because it was the first story, and that's where I got to see what he was doing with the backlit, you know, panel sort of things with the shots and everything. It wasn't, you know, green screen. They just did that. They were, what they said were theatrical screens, and they just changed the light, and then those sort of exaggerated comic book things just appeared behind them. To me, it was like, oh, that's so cool.
I wish more people would do that. I wish more people would embrace that sort of comic book style in their filmmaking. And I just love it so much. Although, we talked earlier about this, you know, the whole movie being kind of a throwback to EC Comics. And obviously, like, style-wise, I think Father's Day, it feels pure EC Comics at times. But, you know, it's not like this is some unbreakable rule with those comics, you know. But when I think of them, you know, Tales from the Crypt and Vault of Horror, you know, I always imagine that the basic template of most of those stories is, you know, bad people do bad things and they get some sort of wickedly ironic comeuppance for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe having a half dozen stories just like that back to back in an anthology would get kind of tiresome. So I understand the need for variety, you know, in the movie. But, you know, past its look, Father's Day, you know, it really feels like an EC story for the first half. But after Bedelia is killed, it almost becomes more of a slasher movie in a way, you know, with a villain picking off a house full of victims one by one. You know, it kind of drops EC type of storytelling while still embracing the flavor of it and the look of an EC comic. And, you know, I'm not knocking it for that. I think it's still great. But it was kind of interesting in a way, especially considering that down the line we get a story that feels like it could have come right from Tales from the Crypt. But
sure.
But I still, overall, I love it. Although, you know, I hadn't revisited the movie in a while, and watching it again, something kind of stood out to me plot-wise. You know, we're told about Aunt Bedelia taking care of her wealthy father, and, you know, until he had her sort of elderly, you know, beau murdered. And then right. She killed him with the marble ashtray. And she returns to the family home every year for, you know, 7 long years. And I'm no longer sure about the timeline here. You know, it's mentioned that Bedelia is pretty much older than God, apparently, but mention was made of her September romance with her much older boyfriend of 75, and she killed her own father only 7 years prior to that for killing her boyfriend. So did I miss something, or?
I think they're just, I think all the relatives are being, a little cheeky in their exaggeration about age and stuff like that. I don't think you're supposed to read into it too much. Why 7 years? why is he coming out of the grave now? I know, you know, it's just like, well, cause that's the story we're telling right now. It's like, why, you know, I don't think it's like, well, why'd he wait so long? I don't think there's anything, you know, intrinsically important about 7 years. I just thought it's like, hey, you know, it's like, because this is the story here's where we're telling the story right now. So I think that's it, but I don't think that, you know,
I don't think Nathan was
184 anything like that before he was killed. But and that really freaked me out too, was the, and it was just blood on the guy's face, but the way they did it, and he fell down into this frame and he had blood. I was like, I was a very naive kid as far as horror went. And most of modern horror had at that point really scared me. And it's still with Creepshow, it still scared me, but, I never read into that. And I just think that, you know, it's still an EC revenge story because, look, that entire family was a bunch of, you know, jackasses who are all sort of reveling in the fact that, you know, finally this old bastard is dead and we've got all his money. You know? And he's like, screw you. I'm going to kill you and get my cake that I never got. And, you know, I think to read too much into subtext with Creepshow is unnecessary.
Yeah. No, I'm having a bit of fun with it. Although I will argue later on that there is a little bit of subtext to be found with one of the stories that I think is kind of fascinating. But we'll get there.
Sure.
But I will say, you know, with Father's Day, I think for as fun and comic booky as that tale is, there is just a little bit of great drama there with Bedelia at her father's grave, sort of railing against him. And I think Vivica Lindfors, she gives a really great performance in that scene, you know, just before Nathan rises from the grave and, you know, that great comic book lighting hits. I mean, but she does something there. I mean, that could have been a throwaway scene. It could have been a mere setup for, you know, that jump scare. But the fact that she took that, what, minute maybe of screen time to
that rant, that wonderful rant, which I, from what I understand, that's all her. That wasn't in the script the way it was. She went off and improv, which I guess, again, from what I've read and everything, really bothered Stephen King that she didn't stick to the script.
Really?
And I think that was, I would guess that's the one that feels like the most primal and cathartic in a way. And it was. It was like, wow. But I think that's what really, to me, makes the movie feel as good as it is, because these actors are, you can tell, they're not walking through this. They're bringing their A game. And you see the passion of her venom towards nothing. And it just like, okay, I get it. You know, this was an awful, awful man. And then it gets back to the fun. But I mean, even then you just go, wow, the power of really, really great acting. And thank God Romero was just like, do what you want. You are Vivica Lindfors. I trust you. And he had command, you know, in that way. And he knew how to inspire actors to do their best.
Yeah, and that's
what you always want. That's what you always want to be able to do is like, okay, this person needs this. Let me let him go. Do your thing.
So we get to the end of that story and Nathan gets his cake. And then from there, we move on to the lonesome death of Jordy Verrill.
That's a meteor. I'd be dipped in shit if that ain't a meteor. Meteor shift.
You ain't gonna get in that top, are you? The water there at once, Jordy. You get in that water, Jordy. You might as well sign your death warrant.
I'm a goner already, Daddy. Ain't I?
Please, God. Let my luck be in. Just this once.
And in today's weather, the current 30-day forecast released by the U.S. Meteorological Station at Portland calls for moderating temperatures and lots of rain.
And I remember at the time, I didn't know what Stephen King looked like, so I had no idea this was Stephen King. I had no idea who the actor was or anything. I grew up in Vermont, so I looked at that sort of setting and everything and feeling very familiar with this sort of off-the-beaten-path kind of thing. But I remember it was like this was a nice break because the first one at times really freaked me out and scared me, and then this one was obviously more comedic.
Yeah, due in no small part, I think, to King playing his part really, really broadly. I mean, it's probably the most comedic of all the stories, I think. But, you know, he's such a goofball in it. And it's hard to take it seriously in a way, even though, I mean, it's beautifully shot and the effects are great. But, you know, for all of that, I mean, as different as it seems from Father's Day and the opening segment, you know, tonally, it still feels one kind of a piece with everything. You know, it's yet another comic book tale brought to life. But, you know, on top of that, there is a really, really dark and sad ending that tops what is otherwise kind of a comedy up until that point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, say that it's the most broad comic story of the entire piece. But I remember also being like a little, like when he does his daydreaming about going to the doctor, and you got the Dutch angles and the skeleton just rolling by and everything else, and it's like, wow, that's really creepy. And then the doctor was kind of creepy looking in his own way, and he takes out the meat cleaver, and he goes, this is going to be extremely painful. Again, as a young kid, I'm going, this is kind of okay, this is kind of creepy. And the funny thing is, looking at it now, going, oh, that doctor is also his father in it. It's basically every person that he imagines, it's the same actor in it. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing. There is no story in this that I don't like now. I love Stephen King's performance in this one. I think it's funny. It doesn't, and the story doesn't, it doesn't stay too long. It's not one of the longer stories, so it doesn't, like just drag on. It like sort of gets to its point and does it pretty quick. But yeah, just the nature of, as funny as it is, then there is that sort of underlying, like, oh God, something just growing on you and never stopping and just getting worse and worse over a matter of hours, just overtaking you is if you really think about it, it's like, wow, this is really, really, kind of creepy. And then that super tragic ending, which if you're not going to have an ironic ending, you'll have this inevitable tragic ending. And then again, like I said before, just that last shot with the radio guy talking about the weather and seeing that last shot with the plant just reaching out, into the valley, or, out to the out, moving, basically you go, this is going to take over everything. In some ways it could be seen as like an end of the world story.
Absolutely. And I love that is the final shot that they chose to, use and, to transition into the comic book panel before going to the next story, because it does feel like, you're right, it feels like we've witnessed something that's pre-apocalyptic.
Yeah, I love all those comic panels and those comic transitions. I'm so jealous that here's just a note of like, oh, this is what you can get when you are deservedly so hugely successful. The last time I talked to Greg Nicotero, he has all of those comic panels from the entire movie, all the transition panels, all the comic panels from the movie. And I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. So yeah. I think the placement of these stories is great because it's a great palate cleanser from the last one. And I think Romero did a great job of always keeping you on your toes and not knowing what to expect next. And King did too with the stories, where each one is, for the most part, so different. I mean, we get to the next one, something to tide you over.
It's your turn!
There's a chance you can get out of this, Harry. The tide might even set you free. Depends on how long you keep it cool, how long you hold your breath, you see.
Oh, the tide. Coming in.
I'm gonna get you. You hear me, Richard? You hear me, Richard? I'm gonna get you!
Gotta hold your breath there, Harry.
You can shoot us dead, Richard, because you're falling. They dug a hole for you, Richard. On the beach, it's your turn. You can hold your breath. If you can hold your breath.
I die!
arguably the most, along with Father's Day, the most EC Comics sort of flavored tale.
It really is. I think something that tied you over, it is the most EC Comics, I think, out of all of them. It feels like an old Tales from the Crypt story brought to life in a way. It even feels more Tales from the Crypt to me than anything in the HBO Tales from the Crypt, which I love. I'm not knocking it, but I mean, it feels like such a perfect representation of what those tales would do. Again, right down to, you know, the setup where, you know, a bad person does something bad and is punished for it in, you know, kind of an ironic way. And, you know, there are only three people in the story, but it tells a tale that I think feels like it could almost be feature length. And I feel like in some way, like all of these stories could be expanded upon, but I just, Something to Tide You Over is one of my very favorites in this film. It's either between this or The Crate, but I, you know, it's usually my favorite is whichever one that I'm viewing at the time. So The Crate inevitably always wins, but it's right. Just, it's so great. And Leslie Nielsen is so wonderful. And I feel like younger audiences only know him as a comedic actor, you know, for his spoofs or, you know, if they know him at all.
But either from Airplane or now The Naked Gun, probably. Or, I mean, and I would say even, you know, people much younger than I am, you know, they go, oh, that was, I don't even know if they would remember him like from,
Scary
oh, that's
movie?
Mr. Magoo or Scary, maybe Scary Movie would probably be like one of the last, you know, really visible parts that he would be known for. And it's funny because I'd seen Airplane, but I didn't really, at that time, my retention wasn't that great. So I didn't really go, oh, that's the guy from Airplane. So I didn't have any of that baggage with me with him.
Yeah, and he is funny in a very wicked way in the movie, but he's also really chilling. I mean, he made for one hell of a villain, I think, and I wish he had gotten the opportunity to play more parts like this.
Well, the thing is, you have to remember that, you know, he was also a dramatic actor, you know, before Airplane. I mean, he was the star of Forbidden Planet.
Very true.
Yeah. So it was like, I think a lot of the times that, you know, comedians are really great in dramatic or menacing roles because it's so different from what you associate them with. And I think, you know, comedy and horror have such a kinship together. They're so close together as far as timing and what they do and everything that I think a great example is Robin Williams in One Hour Photo.
Sure.
You know, there's nothing funny about that part at all.
No winking whatsoever at the audience. It's just at all.
It's just all disturbing. And also Insomnia. I mean, he was one of these real great chameleons when he finally got the opportunity to show a more serious side that really worked. And that's the thing. You get someone like... you know, like in this part, and you just sort of go, okay, you know, this is a professionally trained actor. He can do anything. And I think that's why it's so disturbing that Leslie Nielsen is this guy. I think now, more so when you look at it now, you can also see him having a ton of fun. He definitely got what they were making. I mean, just the stuff with him, you know, talking to them, and you know, he was having a blast doing this part.
And he has like the traditional EC Comics moment, I think, more than anybody else in the film, when he is trying to escape, you know, the zombie Harry and Becky, and he's backing away from the door that he's just barred against them, and he turns on into them. And then you get that great close-up on his face and the background changes like it's already done before. But just the pose that he strikes and the look on his face, that is the good Lord choke moment.
Oh, you know? My God. And his scream when he turns around and runs right into them. And it's just – it's a bone-chilling scream. You're just like, holy shit. I mean, that he sold real terror there. And then he sold I'm so terrified – I've gone mad as he's trying to unlock the door and he starts laughing. And you just like, you know, again, like I always say, it was like, I was not laughing at Creepshow, as funny it is. And I get all the jokes and the joy of it now as a kid seeing it for the first time, I'm freaking out. That jump scare scared me. The zombies, their look scared me. And his reaction freaked me out. And the whole nature, this whole nature of let me bury you up to your neck and you can't move and the tide's coming in and you are going to drown in the most horrible way. There is not a shred of hope that you're going to get out of this. Was absolutely horrifying in that concept.
Yeah, there is not a time that I don't watch this movie and think, I would just prefer to be shot. Like, yeah. I understand why he wasn't. He had to see how things were going to go. Maybe he could wiggle his way out of the sand. But, you know, damn it, Harry, just take the bullet because that's going to be better.
I think it's really powerful that, you know, they take Becky and they show Ted Danson's character what's going to happen to him before you see it. So then that most chilling line in the story, the tide. He just, you know, Leslie Nielsen just looks up after the TV has blanked out. You know, you've seen Becky kind of go underwater and you're like, oh, and then he just looks up, looks out and goes, the tide. And you're like, oh, no. And then Romero shows you and you're just like, wow, it's fantastic. I always thought that one was one of the lesser ones to me. That was one of my least favorite at the time because it was just like, okay, it's another zombie thing and everything else. But now I look at it and it's, again, it's probably right under my, it's either top three or number four out of the five stories, which is horrible. It's very hard to pick a favorite out of these now.
It is because
the more I watch it, the more I get different things from it. And I appreciate that story so much more than I did as a kid.
Yeah, it's a great one. You know, we definitely sang Leslie Nielsen's praises. I should definitely take a second to say that Ted Danson is also really great in it. And so is Galen Ross. Galen plays Becky, you know, Franny yeah. from Romero's Dawn of the Dead, you know, plays poor Becky in this story. And, you know,
talk about a thankless role, though, in a lot of ways. I mean,
although she is great for the minute and a half that she's on screen, like she, it's kind of heart wrenching. Like you can see Harry sort of just dying at seeing, you know, this woman that he loves, you know, going underwater. And I think that she, you know, you're right. It is thankless in a way because she was buried up to her neck and, you know, she.
You really, unless you know who she is, you really don't recognize her.
No. But her performance, I think, is still, you know, pretty great even for what little time that she's given. And it reminded me, you know, she's such a good actress and one who sadly didn't really work all that much. You know, she's looking at her career. She's directed and she produces documentaries, but she only acted in what, like three films? It was like this and Dawn of the Dead and Mad Men. Yeah, she was in that slasher film. So, but
she doesn't even, you know, she took a different name for
it. Was it Alexis Dubin? Something like that?
Yeah, Alexis Dubin. And it was so obvious it was her. It was very strange, but I mean, I guess just because it's like, oh, because it's a slasher movie or something, but I have a lot of affection for that movie too, in its own weird way. So, she did. I mean, there's definitely she brought the pathos to her moments at least. So.
Yeah. And Danson was great too. He, you know, at times it feels like he's acting in a different movie from Leslie Nielsen. Like it's two very different types of performances they're giving, but I think that works for the story. I mean, it's appropriate, I think. And,
Well, I think you have to have it. You have to have him be the grounding element that lets Leslie Nielsen go off and be crazy. You have to have that contrast to actually make the story really work.
Absolutely. And, you know, weird note, I suppose, but I wanted to point out the musical score in this segment. You know, a lot of the film's music is you know, kind of big and bold to support the types of stories that are being told. And, you know, great work, too, by composer John Harrison. But there's this great cue that plays when Richard goes back to the beach to sort of confirm Harry's death. And it's this really haunting tune that kind of reminded me of Carnival of Souls for some reason, you know, the music in that, which, you know, it's kind of fitting in a way if that was meant to be any sort of nod. But it's just a great moment. And it reminds me that this movie has a really, really, really great musical score in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of John Harrison and, again, it's the last, I think, if I'm correct, of Romero's sort of library track music, too, because there's cues from Night of the Living Dead and I think even parts of library music from Dawn of the Dead that are also in this movie, which is really interesting. You know, before he could afford a composer, or, you know, he always went back to library music that now would probably cost thousands of dollars to use in your movie, but he used it so well. But they had that one piece, which I believe that John Harrison did, which was a cover of a famous song, a famous tune for the moment that you were talking about when he drives back to his house. And that was the first time that I saw a house that, you know, I mean, this was like a real videophile guy, you know, in a movie who could record things and had all these, you know, closed circuit TVs and everything else and the screen that, you know, moved down and, you know, all that stuff. Was like, wow, all right, that was a little ahead of its time.
Yeah, absolutely. And at risk of looking a little too closely at it, I'm still not entirely certain how some of that setup worked, but I'm willing to buy into it.
He had a lot of cable.
Yeah.
A lot of cable coming out of that Jeep. So, you know.
Yeah, that's great. And from there, we go to the crate.
This is Henry and Wilma Northrup.
Oh, just call me Billy. Everyone does. I mean, some of these so-called academics make the shark in Jaws look like fucking
flipper. Look, I'd be almost willing to bet that crate's full of National Geographic's, you know, back issues of the Reader's Digest.
Something in there, huh? Something shiny.
Two people are dead already. It was that thing in the crate. I don't even know where it was.
What are you doing, Henry? What are you doing?
What I should have done a long time ago.
Just tell it to call you Billy.
What if it gets out, Henry?
That thing is drowned in its box 70 feet down. Relax.
Easily the best story, the centerpiece, the tops in my book as far as stories go with this one.
And by quite a bit, the longest segment in the entire movie, you know, topping out at nearly 40 minutes.
And just filled with great performances. I mean, just it's so much fun, and it's easily got like the coolest monster, and some of the greatest stuff. I mean, you could tell it was like, okay, this is our centerpiece. This is the one. We're putting it all in here. And again, great performances. I had no idea who Fritz Weaver was before this movie. Hal Holbrook I'd known, and Adrian Barbeau I was aware of beforehand. So, it's just like, and again, to me, very, very, very creepy at the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned Adrienne Barbeau. Her Wilma, you know, her Billy character, I think might be maybe the most despicable, just utterly heinous character in all of horror cinema. You know, or maybe not, but I mean, damn it, she is awful in this movie. Great performance, awful character. And watching the movie again, revisiting it, I sort of imagine in my head this sort of road trip from hell that would be, you know, being stuck in a van with Billy and maybe Franklin from Texas Chainsaw, Wendy from The Shining, Harry Cooper from Night of the Living Dead, and then maybe that kid from The Babadook.
I would have just jumped out of the fucking car.
Maybe Crazy Ralph, too. I don't know. I don't know how much space is in this van. But, I mean, she is just terrible in it. And, you know, but what's great about the story, I think, is because she's so terrible, you immediately sympathize with Holbrook's Henry, you know, Henry Northrop.
And a doormat of a character.
And he's fantastic, too, as that sort of long-suffering husband. You know, he's immediately likable and sympathetic. And I, you know, one wonders how the two wound up together in the first place. But what's great is because she's so terrible and you understand where he's coming from, right down to him wanting to kill her. You know, and there are those great moments where Henry fantasizes about killing Billy, you know, the shooting, you know, with the crowd applauding him. And
when I saw it the first time, the entire theater applauded. they just cheered like, yes, thank God, you know. Yeah. It's and I love the line she goes. It's like she's ranting and stuff like that. It's like, you know, this, I forget who the guy is, but this guy makes the shark and Jaws look like fucking Flipper. And you're just like, oh, my God. You know, it was like, what a line. I mean, it's such a she steals the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
She steals the entire movie with that performance. It's such a great performance by
and
her.
Because of that, I think, because she's so despicable and because we like Holbrook, you know, The Crate almost feels like the inverse of a typical EC story. You know, in this case, the person committing the heinous act, you know, murder, feeding a spouse to a monster, you know, he isn't punished. There's no ironic comeuppance. You know, he's actually rewarded for his trouble. And I'm cool with that as an audience member. I'm cool with that as a fan because it feels appropriate, you know.
But I remember at the time seeing, like, jumping forward a little bit, seeing the very end of that short. And Fluffy gets out of the crate underwater and stuff, and he's coming up. I'm like, oh, he's going after them. They're next. It wasn't like they were going to be, like, safe and they were just going to, like, get out. I was like, no, that thing's coming for them now. That was always my
really? Okay.
I was always like, no way. This thing is – you threw me in this quarry and everything. I'm coming to get you now. There's no escape. There is no escape.
I would like to think the Fluffy – you know, if that's the case, maybe he's smart enough to hitch a ride back to Henry's to get, you know, I would like to think he hitches a ride on Jack Burton's, you know, big rig. And because, my God, those two creatures are, it seems like they could be siblings at the very least.
Sure.
But, yeah, I suppose there is that feeling that maybe, you know, Fluffy is going to seek out Henry for revenge. But, you know, God, he's. It's such a great effect, that monster. And all of the gore gags, too. You know, really, it makes me miss that era where you could have effects like that with any sort of regularity.
Well, again, what I liked and what Creepshow did for me when I saw it, and then subsequently after seeing it, it really made me look into Fangoria and getting Grand Illusions, Savini's book on makeup effects, and seeing how it was all done. And I kind of miss the magic trick aspect of horror movies these days. I mean, now that you can do anything, I really appreciate when you can tell that it's a practical effect done with some panache and style and everything, that really it does become a magic trick. And I think that's really lost. And what I loved about The Crate was the fact that you didn't know what was in there. So again, the tension and the buildup of them pulling the crate out is like, felt like something shifted. And then they start opening it, and that montage of opening the crate and hitting it with hammers and prying it open with the crowbars a little bit. And then you get that awesome shot from inside the crate, and they're looking in with the cobwebs and stuff. It was just like, to me, my imagination just ran, what is this thing? And again, he holds off, you know, the guy puts his hand in, he gets bit and attacked, and he only shows it for a little bit at first. It's a beautiful reveal. And then when you see it, it's like, oh my God, what is this thing? Is it a monkey? What is it? It's small. It's got these horrible teeth. It's all just fur, claws, and teeth. And it's just like, yeah, I love that thing. I love that thing. And I love how this was done. It was just like, if there's any weak moments in maybe some of the other stories, which is arguable in my opinion, it all came together with the story so, so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And one that, you know, even though it is the longest in the movie, it doesn't really feel like it overstays its welcome. You know, there is a sense when you're watching it, it's like, you know, maybe the halfway point or three quarters of the way through, you're kind of like, okay, this is definitely longer than the others. This one is more special in a way for that. But, you know, I don't know that it needs any trimming. You know, I don't know that it needs to be shorter. I don't know if it needs to be the length of the other installments, because even at nearly what it's like 36, 38 minutes, it's sort of perfect, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but I think the thing is that, you know, the fact that it, you know, you get the Adrian Barbeau stuff and everything else going on with it, it just feels, they all feel perfectly paced to me. None of them feels like they, you know, outstay their welcome in any aspect. So yeah, I was just so into it, and it had that great moments, like going back under the crawl space, under the stairs, and that wonderful moment where the student is there, and then you see the shadow of the claw go over his face before he's attacked and everything, again, I'm being redundant going. It's great. It's just fantastic. It all came together. The music was really scary and really great, and the choosing of the lighting and stuff. And then just to, like, again, you let her have that rant after he, like, starts slamming her against the crate under the stairs, and she goes on her tirade before she's killed. It's like, here's a reminder of why. And it's funny because you get that moment where Fluffy grabs her and she's screaming, and he sort of like snarls and barks at Hal Holbrook, almost like, but to me it was almost like he was talking to him like, oh, don't worry, I got this. I'm taking her out for you. Don't worry. It's like almost like he, like, you're like, snarl, barks or growls twice at him or something, and it's like he's talking to him, like going, yeah, I got her, it's all right, you know, before he kills her.
I'll handle this if you can't, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder if there's almost an alternate version of that tale to be told where Hal Holbrook's character decides to keep Fluffy, you know, and feeds him other undesirables. I mean,
yeah, he becomes the dean of the university just by, like, feeding people to Fluffy, which would be pretty great.
All right. And then from the crate we go to They're Creeping Up on You.
I have to watch them. Bugs. That's all they are. All of them.
I'm the wife of the man you murdered this afternoon.
Mrs. Katzenmeier, how are you?
I hope they keep hell hot for you. You son of a bitch.
Would you mind telling me who gave you my private number?
There are still roaches in this place, Reynolds. I killed one not 5 minutes ago.
Got bugs again, huh, Mr. Pratt?
Don't you talk to me like that, you hear?
Roaches are very hard to kill. They can creep up on you.
Goddamn bugs.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I would just, you know, you go from the crate and then you go into this one, and it's just like, okay.
Did I say Adrian Barbeau's Billy was maybe the most despicable, utterly heinous character? I'm sorry. I meant E.G. Marshall's Mr. Pratt.
and a super rich, elitist, racist piece of crap. This guy, this guy's going to, you know, push the baby out of the way. If it goes down the stairs, who cares? You're in my way. I'm just, you know, it's all about him.
Yeah. And he's, God, from minute one, he's just awful. I mean, if there is one thing I think that makes the movie ring a little false to me, so far as it being a throwback to those old EC comics, it's all the rampant profanity sort of spewed out by Marshall in this segment. You know, he's not the only one to swear in the film, but He
says fuck more than anyone else combined in the movie. And I remember being a kid and seeing this movie the first time in a theater with my dad.
Oh.
And, yeah, when all the F-bombs came, I felt self-conscious, like going, oh, I'm not supposed to be hearing this. Because I didn't have a family. I didn't have a household that grew up and used that word. So it was not commonplace, you know. So I knew it was pretty scandalous even at the time. And I think my dad even at the time said, yeah, that would have been good if he hadn't swore so much.
Yeah, really sort of grates, I think, against the sort of nostalgia it's attempting for those older comics, you know, that the movie attempts and, you know, mostly succeeds at. It seemed like a strange choice. And you mentioned earlier that Romero allowed Vivica Lindfors to sort of, you know, do that monologue on her own. That's something that wasn't scripted. And now I'm wondering if E.G. Marshall's, you know, constant F-bomb dropping was maybe his own choice and something that perhaps wasn't in the script.
I don't know. I think it was really just to make a point with the character that he was, you know, I mean, he just used the stuff very flippantly. It was just like, it was nothing to him. It was like, you know, you did a good job. Go out and fuck someone. Wear rubber. Everyone's got the damn herpes these days. It's like, it was just like, this guy had no filter. He didn't need to. He was, you know, a captain of industry. He was a titan that lived in his white palace and everything. And he didn't have to. To me, it was like he didn't have to, you know, he didn't care what anyone thought. He didn't have to. He was rich enough. He was that powerful. And that's, to me, what I always, like, read from it. And it was all about, because of that, he didn't care. I mean, the fact that, I mean, I love, oh, my God, I love, you know, that his assistant tells him that, you know, Norman Gassemeyer just killed himself. And he goes, wonderful. You know, now we don't have to offer the bastard a seat on the board. It's like, oh, yeah, and everything else. And then
the call widow with the wife. Oh.
And she goes, Mrs. Kassemeyer, how are you? It's just like, oh, my God, you bastard. You know? And then he's like, he doesn't care. She's going, I hope you die. I hope you rot in hell and stuff like that. And he's like, how'd you get my number? Like, wait a minute. The most important thing is, how'd you get my number to call me? It was like, wow. Yeah. And the other thing that bothered me about that one is I really hate cockroaches. So that always, always got under my skin. It was just like, oh, this is horrible.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's the ickiest of all of them, even for the, you know, the decapitation in one story and seeing people getting chewed up and, you know, all of the, you know, seeing somebody drown in a really sort of protracted way. Like, I agree. The worst thing in the movie to me is seeing a cockroach blended up in the guy's food and in the cereal box.
He's eating it and then he just looks and you're like, oh, no, you know. I'm eating chewed up bugs, and whatever he's eating looks disgusting anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and then he finds roaches in them that are chewed up. You're like, no, God, this is awful. Yeah.
And that segment too, it also seems to have, I think, a bit more subtext than the previous installments, you know, just a bit more depth beyond the fun sort of macabre entertainment that the other stories provide. You know, by presenting Pratt as a racist, I think, you know, there's his interaction with Mr. White, who's black, and there's that sort of racist quality to the way he treats him and that racial barb that he tosses at him when he's on the phone with him later as he's
it's like, you know, there's people like you, you know, you might go far away. I know as people like you often do, you know, people of color, and you're just like, Jesus Christ, you know. And the weird, his perception of White when he sees him, you know, White's talking normal on the other side of the door, but he sees him as like, what's up, Mr. Pratt? Got bugs again? It's all exaggerated. And, you know, his just view of the world is horrible.
Yeah. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And plus, you know, it's fun that just visually they kind of support that too, where, you know, there's that obsession he has with keeping his apartment sort of pristine and white and, you know, and not inviting, you know, White in to speak with him. You know, he keeps him on the other side of the door. And, you know, and then there's that notion, too, I think, of Pratt being this sort of cruel, millionaire businessman who has no qualms with crushing the little guy beneath his feet, you know, even equating other people with being bugs.
And, sure.
You know, the roaches which invade his apartment, they almost seem to be called forth, I think, by Miss Kastenmeier, you know, the widow of, you know, just one such little guy who killed himself, you know, on Pratt's account. And it feels like, you know, the roaches are almost the ultimate little guy in this story. You know, they dodge Pratt's foot, they work together, and they take him down in a really gruesome fashion. And I think there's almost sort of a wish fulfillment with this story, you know, there for the audience, I think, because of all of that.
Sure. You know, I think it's not just called on him. I think it's called by not just her, but by all the people that he stepped on. And he goes, you know, I grew up in Hell's Kitchen, you know, and he worked his way up and everything. So he's setting up that he's stepped on a lot of people to get to where he is. My whole thing was like, I know it was going for this Howard Hughes sort of style of apartment and living and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, who would want to live there? What, you can't even sit down. There's nothing. It's like, you have no, where's the TV? Where's, you know, there's no comfort in his obsession of being ultra clean too, which was very strange.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it ends obviously with the show stopping showstopper of an effect, which is also just horrible. Just thinking about all these roaches inside of you and everything. And I just, you know, and it was such a shock at the time for me because it was like, where'd they all go? They killed him. Where'd he go? And then they just burst out of him. You know, like, oh my God, it ended on this really truly horrifying, grotesque moment.
Absolutely. And one that feels, you know, again, like some of the earlier stories in the movie, very EC Comics, very, you know, the evil person got their comeuppance. You know, I love it so much. And that final shot, though, is truly disturbing. Like the safe room filled with bugs. It's like, were they all inside of him? Did that?
You know,
but it's just, oh
thing.
My God.
Yeah. They all just jammed into him and then came out. And we're like 3 or 4 feet high deep. And you're just like, wow. You know. And they were big. They were just, and some of them were huge. And you're just like, oh, no. All right. I mean, this movie fills all that criteria of King. Those three things is like, you know, I'll try to scare him. If I can't scare him, I'll disturb him. If I can't disturb him, I'll gross them out. You know, it just, this movie does all of them in spades.
Absolutely.
And you can tell, and they revel in it. They have such glee. You can tell with it all. Cause there's so much irony in the movie. And it's just, again, I just think everyone was at the top of their game. Not to say that, you know, subsequent movies and stuff that Romero did or anything weren't good, but I think, you know, he still got to make this movie independently, and then things slowly started to change. I mean, he made Day of the Dead, I think, after this, and then things changed, and he, you know, he went and did Dark Half and Monkey Shines, which were studio things that had problems. So to me, it's like, and maybe again, because this was sort of my first love, there is that wonderful innocence and still just having fun. And it's the stuff that I read about the making of the movie. And, you know, to me, it really is the most fun you'll have being scared. And you just sort of feel that from them making it. And when they talk about it, it's really great.
Absolutely. And then finally from there, we get to the epilogue.
Comic book.
What?
Comic book.
My kids love these things.
I love them too.
Send away for all this stuff here. Look,
an authentic voodoo doll.
Somebody already sent for it.
Yeah, we can't get that.
Stan, are you all right?
Oh, it's this goddamn stiff neck. I can barely move my head.
Oh, Oh, I'll teach you to throw away my comic books.
Ready for another shot, Dad?
And it's so much fun. It's, you know, the fact that we cut outside and we meet the two garbage men, one of which is Tom Savini, you know, and they find Billy's comic. And, you know, we see those great ads that they're flipping through. And then, of course, we get to the, the voodoo doll. And the one garbage man, you know, realizes that, you know, it's already been redeemed.
Yeah. Which is amazing because it's like, well, the parents probably like saw the package. So it was like, but again, that's looking into it too much. You just sort of go, okay. And it's great because it's the, you know, the wraparound's wonderful. And again, it doesn't overstay its welcome. And it ends on, perfect EC Comics style ending. It's like, you know, the dad gets his comeuppance.
In a perfect way, too. The fact that he's actually undone in some small part by not only his son, but by the very comic that he threw away. I love that.
Exactly. And
I wanted to see the further adventures of Billy, which in a way I wonder. We did eventually get a Creepshow 2, which again, I'm not that much of a fan of, but there is
which has Billy in it.
Yeah. Now, is that the Billy or is it a Billy?
I mean, it's meant to be. Yes.
Yeah. I wish Joe King could have come back for that.
Yeah, I know. It's meant to be the same character, but but to me, but you know, the nice thing is we get with the ending, and then it ends with again the creep pulling the comic back. You get that final shot with the candle going out, and you get the great theme playing, and it was like it just blew me away. It just blew me away so much because I, you know, as scared as I was at times watching it, which seems very funny now, but I was very impressionable and easily influenced, I think, that back then. It just opened the floodgates for me to, you know, dive down into that horror rabbit hole that I've been in ever since.
All right. Now, can I ask?
Yes.
We had Creepshow 2, and then there was, you know, Tales from the Dark Side, which, as I understand, was meant to maybe at some point be Creepshow 3. But then we did eventually get a Creepshow 3, which I admit I haven't yet seen. I read not so great reviews about it, and then, you know, I understand that Romero and King had nothing to do with it, and so I haven't made my way around to watching it yet.
I just sort of refuse. I've been told not to see it. Creepshow 2 was enough of a, you know, honestly, it was enough of a bummer for me because it's, you know, it's so far removed. It's just an anthology movie to me. Really, it really is because it has none of the flavor or the style that the first one had. The Raft is a great story. It's just its execution is not so great, but I guess, you know, looking back on it so many years later, people are really liking it, but I was always really let down by that one.
Same here.
So to me, there's only really one, and 3 is just, it doesn't, without Romero and King's involvement, it doesn't work for me. It's not a Creepshow thing for me.
Yeah. And there was that one attempt apparently to bring it back a few years back. Was it a web series of some sort, Creepshow Raw, I think, but it didn't seem to go anywhere.
No, I think they did one episode. Again, it was sort of through Warner Brothers Digital or some weird way. But now I just think you're trying to cash in on a title. I know there was talk about trying to remake in some way Creepshow, but almost doing it more in the vein of Trick or Treat. And I don't think that ever happened. I mean, I just think that, you know, some things are better left alone.
I think, you know, it is crazy that with such a recognizable title and such potential that somebody isn't pursuing it, you know, but I think there is only one way to do it. And you mentioned it yourself. I mean, you need Romero and you need King. I mean, get Romero behind the camera again, give him some damn money, you know, adapt a handful of Stephen King tales. And then, you know, they could sit back and enjoy the success that formula and a good deal of nostalgia might bring. And, you know, I don't know. Could you ever see Creepshow making a return like that?
Never say never, but I think it's less and less likely. And I think we just have to, you know, we have to look at it and be sort of thankful for what there is. And then, you know, maybe down the road we will get other people who have been inspired by it to do something in the same spirit. But I think a lot of things are just sort of timing, and the timing just sort of came together and was perfect for this movie and for the way it was. I mean, I think it would be an expensive prospect now to get stars and everything the way they did this one, even in small roles, you know, to do it. And to get King back would, you know, probably be an expensive, you know, avenue to go down. So yeah, I just kind of look at it as it's its own little perfect thing.
I think we've just about reached our time, sir. Before we go, can I ask, do you have any final thoughts to share on Creepshow?
I'm just really, I'm thankful eternally to George Romero and Stephen King for having the love for EC Comics the way they did, for making this movie the way they did, for everyone who was a part of it, for Tom Savini to introduce me to the world of makeup effects and all the magic tricks and everything that he did, and for really inspiring me to want to make movies and, you know, hopefully someday having the chance to be able to get to do something in the same spirit, and maybe even pay tribute in style to what this you know movie did for me. It's a really special movie, I really want to thank them for making this. It was the movie that made me want to make movies, and you know, I can't imagine a better thank you than that. Hopefully, you know, someday, you know, I get to do something that does the same for someone else.
I think that's a perfect way to end. Thank you so much. Can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future?
I am on Twitter at TayParker666 and Dave Parker on Facebook. That's where people can find me. And I'm currently just writing and working on some new stuff now, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about that stuff, you know, sooner than later. But there's nothing exactly in the pipeline right now, but working on stuff and talking to people, so we'll see.
Very cool. All right. Well, thanks again for your time and for choosing such a great movie to talk about. It was a blast, and it's definitely a movie that deserves all the love that it gets, I think.
Thank you. This was great. This was such a pleasure to do. Thank you for allowing me the time to blather on about this movie. It really means a lot. It's great.
Thank you. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, rate and review us on iTunes. Yell at us on Facebook and Twitter. That's at Screamatics, and I'm at Jinx1981. Until next time, folks, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Wilma!
Hell of a shot.
What was that?